verse 11. Isaiah 2, verse 11. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, the haughtiness of men bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. Verse 17. The loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. Chapter 6, please. Verse 1. Isaiah 6, verse 1. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne high and lifted up. The border of his robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. One cried to another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. Then I said, Woe is me, for I am undone, ruined, cut off, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Finally, from chapter 10, please. From chapter 10, verse 5. Woe to Assyria! The rod of my anger and the staff in whose hand is my indignation, I will send him against an ungodly nation. And against the people of my wrath, I will give him a charge to seize the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Yet he does not mean so. Nor does his heart think so. It is in his heart to destroy and to cut off not a few nations. That's all we purpose reading tonight from the Bible. What day do I finish? Letting Malcolm loose on a book of 66 chapters, the mind boggles. I haven't found it particularly easy to construct a character study for the man Isaiah. It may have 66 chapters, but it's not easy to put together much material about the man himself. The front page of the Western Mail yesterday, there was an article about the man that never was. Some character in the last World War whose body was used by British intelligence to fool German intelligence. Publicly, we don't even know the man's name, so inevitably we don't know anything about his background or life. But we know Isaiah's name, but we still know very little about the man and his background. To start the New Testament, always get things backwards, you start at the back, you ransack the New Testament, discover that there are somewhere about 240 allusions or quotes from Isaiah's work. We encounter his name 22 times. And although we just keep on hitting his name, we learn nothing about him as a man, except just one little isolated quoted the Apostle Paul in Romans 10, Isaiah was very bold, as he lifted in some words of his from chapter 65, but with that exception, nothing. New Testament focuses entirely on the man's message. Not that that's itself without value. According to tradition, Isaiah met a rather grisly end. He was martyred, so it is said, in the days of Manasseh, who was the son of Hezekiah, and he was sawn in half. A Christian of the second century is on record as having written to a Jewish opponent concerning Isaiah, who you sawed asunder in the days of Manasseh with a wooden saw. The writer of the Hebrews, great catalogue of faith, Hebrews 11, verse 37, there were some who were sawn asunder. So presumably Isaiah sort of creeps into verse 37 there. Well, that's probably what happened to the man. Well, whether it did or didn't, it certainly happened to his book ever since, or certainly in the recent past. As critics have ripped it apart and divided it up, at least into two sections, usually a lot more, but they certainly won't allow chapters 1 to 37 to 39 to belong to the same pen as the second half of the book. But it's interesting, this New Testament, which I'm going to leave in just a second, the way the New Testament handles the writing of Isaiah. Matthew, for instance, six times he attributes passages of Isaiah to that name. Three of them are from the first half of the book, three from the second. Curiously, Paul does the same. Three from the first half, three from the second, specifically attributed to the name Isaiah. The Apostle John goes even further, and in the space of three verses, he brings together two quotes, one from chapter 53, one from chapter 6, so he's straddling that division. And he says, when he's quoting from chapter 53, the bit about Lord who hath believed our report, he said, these things, that is the fact that our Lord had performed many signs before people and they still didn't believe in him, this happened that the word of the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. And then he goes on and says, therefore they could not believe because Isaiah says again. And then his quote about the Lord blinding people's eyes and heart in their heart. This comes from chapter 6. So he's put the two together. Anyway, New Testament, tonight dismissed. No biographical material, no information about the man Isaiah. Right, Old Testament. Well, leave the prophecy just for a moment. Let's have a go at the historical books. Well, he comes on the scene in 2 Kings 19 and 20. His name occurs a handful of times. And his name occurs just three times in the second book of Chronicles. But apart from the fact that you're told that he wrote two histories, and he prayed twice, and he spoke in God's name on five occasions in that section, in those sections, you learn nothing still. Yes, he speaks to God on behalf of the people, and yes, he speaks for God to the people. And when you said that, you really said all that the history books tell you. So we come, full of hope and expectation, to the 66 chapters of the prophecy. But to be rather disappointed, because we find again very few references to the man himself. If you exclude chapter 6, which seems to have been his initial call, there are only two historical sections, chapters 7 and 8, and chapters 36 to 39. The first bit, really, you're focused on King Ahaz, the second time is Hezekiah, the first time there's a threat from Israel and Syria up in the north, the second time the threat is from Assyria, who decided under Sennacherib and his Rabshakeh to besiege Jerusalem, to no great effect, as the sequel proved. But you don't learn much about the man. And if I could summarize where we've got so far, we are saying he managed to write 66 chapters and hardly mention himself. That's not bad going for a preacher. Very faithful to his commission. At the beginning, God had said, well, go and tell. And he went and he told. And he told God's message. And this great formula, thus saith the Lord, 97 times he used it. He's got a lot to say, but what he's doing is heralding a message for the Lord, not talking about himself, much to the chagrin of the preacher who this evening has got the job of speaking about the man. So we get just a few very simple, basic facts about him, lacking any real personal details. We know his father's name. His name was Amos, not the chap who wrote the Old Testament prophecy. And we know that this man's work for God was anchored into the reign of four kings of Judah. And we can locate it then historically. He's about as near as matters, give or take a few inches, halfway between Moses and the Lord Jesus. His work must have spanned over 40 years, so he had a good innings, even if he did get sawn in half at the end. And it was a very checkered history. It was a very... he saw a lot of changes in his life. Sometime he spent his life preaching under godly kings like Jotham and Hezekiah. And sandwiched between those two worthy characters, there was the infamous Ahaz, one of the worst kings that Judah ever had. So he saw a lot of changes. He was married, very happily married. His wife comes on the scene once under the name of the prophetess. Unlike some of the other characters, Jeremiah, forbidden by the Lord to marry Hosea, and suffering an unfaithful wife, and something of an unhappy marriage. To put it mildly, Ezekiel, his wife died somewhere in the course of his public preaching. But this man, happily married, he has at least two sons. Rather unusual but significant name. The one chap, the man, carried the name Shear Jashub. A remnant shall return, that is, shall return to the Lord. Carried in his name, there was hope for a people who were pretty short of it at the time, that in spite of the prevailing ungodliness, there would be a nucleus in the nation that would turn spiritually to the Lord, and the other young man had been graced by his father with the grand name Maher Shahal Hashbaz. Haste. Spoil, speed, pray. It was a reference to the fact that they didn't really need to panic about this little confederacy up in the north. The Lord was going to bring the Assyrian down, and he'd sort them all out. But it was a bit of a mouthful, nevertheless. I've often thought that the poor lad couldn't have done very well at school, because he probably half the time of the examination had passed before he'd finished writing his name. But that was his problem, and it's not mine. I've often thought back on my little life, and when our first son John was born, we were studying Luke chapter 1, and we hit the little expression, "His name shall be John," and that was that. Had we been in Isaiah 8, he would never have forgiven me. I don't suppose he'd have done any worse at school, but I really can't comment on that. Isaiah chapter 8 tells us that this man had a group of disciples, loyal, faithful disciples, who gathered round him and did a splendid job of taking notes of his teachings, and handed them on to others and preserved them. Otherwise, presumably, we wouldn't have them. And there you are. And that's really all you were told directly, explicitly, about the man. Thankfully, it is possible to catch some further glimpses of the man if we look hard at his writings. I mentioned the fact that in the historical books, he comes on the scene as a man of prayer, and he was that. He was also a man of great faith, great courage, great compassion, a man of great ability. Let's race through them. Here's this man, we say, of great faith. He had faith in God. So when the writer of the Hebrews says, "The time would fail me to speak of Gideon and Jephthah and Samson and that, and of the prophets," this man no doubt was included in that umbrella term. He certainly did a good job of encouraging other people to put their faith and trust in the Lord. It's from this man that we collect that bit from Isaiah 26, "Thou wilt keep him in peace, peace, whose heart is stayed on thee, because he trusts in thee." Trust in the Lord forever, in the Lord is everlasting strength.
That's how he addressed others. He taught them to fear the Lord and to fear him and none other. So in chapter 8, he's saying to the people, don't go saying a confederacy to all those who are saying a confederacy. Panic. You have to panic and set in now, because these two pokey nations in the north had got together and they were going to come down and attack Judah. Don't do that, he says. And neither fear what they fear. That is the people who are running around in panic. Sanctify the Lord, he says, in your hearts. Let him be your fear. Somebody who turned the direction of other people to trust in the Lord, to fear him, to wait on him, to wait for him. What's that end of chapter 40? They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. You can come back into chapter 30. It's a great verse, verse 18. It says this, therefore will the Lord wait, that he may be gracious to you. Blessed are all they that wait for him. The Lord's waiting, so that he may be gracious. And blessed are all those who wait for him. He's teaching people to wait for and wait upon the Lord. In quietness and confidence shall be your strength. He taught others that. He taught them to rest and to lean wholly upon the Lord. Chapter 48 says this. They call themselves the holy city. They rely. They support themselves. The authorized verses got, they stay. They settle. They rest themselves upon the God of Israel. The Lord of hosts is his name. Now that's his ministry to others. But it's quite clear from the little we see of him that he practiced fully what he preached. He himself waited on God. This is how he put it in chapter 8. I will wait upon the Lord. I will look for him. And so he waited upon the Lord. He had no doubt whatever. This man of great faith was saying. He had no doubt whatever, when you come to the section, that historical section, chapters 36 and 37, and Jerusalem now is besieged by Sennacherib's great army. He had no doubt whatever of the Lord's ability to defend his city, to defend Jerusalem, and to defend it against the might of the world's greatest military machine. Assyria had just run as a steamroller over every nation and city that stood in its way until it came to Jerusalem. Precedents weren't good. And the Rabshakeh stands outside the wall and he jibes in. Where are the gods, he says, of Hamath and Arphad? They didn't perform particularly well. You've got this man of great faith. And to counter the Rabshakeh's, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, Isaiah came back, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, who is it you've reproached? The Holy One of Israel. I will defend this city for my own name's sake, and for David my servant's sake. And 185,000 corpses were there the next morning to prove the Lord meant what he said. Only one angel needed to do that. The prophet had great faith. He had great faith in the next sort of section there, chapter 38. He's got the confidence that God can cause the shadow to turn back, return 10 degrees up the step sundial of Ahaz. Scientifically, I'm not sure. I've got theories, doesn't matter. I believe it. And Isaiah believed it before it happened. I believe it because it says it happened. But he was confident in a God who could do that. I've often thought, it's a good thing folk in those days didn't play around with time like we do with British summertime. It would have been murder putting the sundial back or on an hour every 6 months. Now, the Lord didn't need to worry about that. And, Isaiah didn't either. He had complete confidence in the Lord's power. A man of great faith. Man who, when everybody else is running in other directions, so if If there's a threat from this Confederacy in the north, they will trust in Assyria. Or they'll trust later on in coalitions with Egypt or in the fortifications and defenses of Jerusalem to keep the Assyrian out. And through it all, this man just stood there, calm, unruffled, untroubled, unflustered. Why? Because he had faith in a great God, that's why. As we'll see in just a moment. This man not only had a detailed knowledge of the earlier scriptures, and he did. I was talking there recently in Bethesda about something in the book of Judges. And there it is, Isaiah knows all about the Gideon battle with Midian. He's got it all set out in two of his chapters. Knows his Old Testament, as we would say. But far more important for Isaiah and his people was that he had a personal knowledge, experience, I suppose we'd say in present jargon, of the Lord. He knew God. And that is really what marked him off. So even the godly Hezekiah will speak to Isaiah of the Lord your God and will crave a place in his prayer. Ask him to pray. To lift up his voice on behalf of the remnant that's left, the remnant that remains. Man of great faith. Man of enormous courage, immense courage. Not afraid. Into the palace. He's got access to the palace, this man. We're thinking in prayer about our privilege coming into the presence of God. Far greater than that. But never mind, it isn't bad. He's got access into the palace. And he's not afraid to denounce kings. So he comes in before King Ahaz, who was not a very bright specimen at the best of times. Hear now, O house of Israel, is it a small thing for you to weary men? Will you weary God also? That's not the way to get promotion. And he didn't care. Didn't hold any man's position as something to be afraid of. And with godly Hezekiah, he will tell him, if the Lord tells him to say it, to put his house in order, because it's time that he's going to die, albeit the sequel shows that he got an extension. Or he will tell him that his descendants and all his treasures are going to be carted off to Babylon, completely fearless before kings. Fearless too before the rulers and the priests and the other prophets. Didn't mince matters, this man. He spoke of them as blind watchmen, dumb dogs that can't and won't bark, and dogs that never have enough. They failed in their duty to warn people of the danger in which they were, and were only interested in seeing themselves all right. He let fly at their drunken behavior, chapter 28. Erred through wine, through strong drink, gone out of the way. Priest and prophet have erred through strong drink, swallowed up wine. They err in vision and stumble in judgment. Well, they got it as well. And the people. There wasn't anybody. There was no rank in Israel that escaped his criticism and censure if their lives merited it. And as far as the people were concerned, he spoke out against the injustice, the ungodliness, the idolatry, the covetousness, the sensuality, the pride. Told them they were like Sodom and Gomorrah. And they were. Very well off, these people. Very affluent. They lived in days unrivaled since David and Solomon had been around. But as Isaiah observed, their land was as full of idols as it was silver and gold. And so we'll tell them in chapter 2. The land is full of silver and gold. Neither is there any end to their treasures. Their land is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands. Children of transgression, inflame yourselves with idols under every green tree. So as I say, he wasn't one to mince matters. And Jerusalem the golden wasn't that in his day. It was Jerusalem the grimy, and Isaiah was one to tell them. So out he speaks. He speaks against all the occult practices, the witchcraft, which he observed, the astrology. His words were these. Let now the astrologers, the word there just means to divide up into sections, to divide up the heavens, house of the zodiac. These are just astrologers. Let now the astrologers and stargazers stand up and save you from the things that will come upon you. You trusted in them, let them save you. So he spoke out, declared these people to be rebels and transgressors and enemies of the Lord and the rest. If there was one thing that upset him, if there was one thing that he honed in on more than anything else, it was the empty ritual and the form of this people, because side by side with their immoral, licentious, ungodly ways, they kept up all appearances. And this Isaiah could not take, their hypocrisy, dead formality. And so he, in ways, right from the beginning of the book to the end, he starts, he kicks off in chapter 1. What use are your sacrifices to me, says the Lord? I'm full of your burnt offerings, rams, and fat of fed beasts. I take no delight in the blood of your bullocks or your he-goats. Then he goes through right to the end, right in the last chapter. He that kills an ox is as if he slew a man. He that sacrifices a lamb as if he broke a dog's neck. Offer an oblation as if you offer swine's blood. Burn incense as if you blessed an idol. They turned to him with their lips, but their hearts were far from him. It was Isaiah who told them that. And it's got great lessons for us. Here they were, they had their observances, they had their attendance at their assemblies, and it was worth absolutely nothing. So, Paul said he was very bold. As I say, that's the only thing I can collect from the New Testament. Prepared to stand up and alone. Great man this. He marched to a different beat to other people. They stood out for God. But this uncompromising, and it was, stand and severity was balanced by a great tenderness, a great gentleness, a great measure of feeling and compassion. He was certainly solid. He was firm, but he was not hard. And in chapter 22, he pleaded. These are his words. Look away from me. Let me weep bitterly. I suppose, literally, we'd say he wanted to exhaust himself with weeping. Don't hurry to comfort me because of the spoiling of the daughter of my people. I know he's not Jeremiah, but they had a lot in common. And although he was aggressive in his attack upon sin in the people, he felt it. He rubbed shoulders with royalty. He was on very familiar terms with them when he took his son, Sheshachshub. Ahaz knew who this lad was, and he knew what his name was. He was that familiar with them. And yet his eyes were never closed to the needs and the situation of the poor of the people. What do you mean that you beat my people to pieces? You crush my people. You grind the faces of the poor, says the Lord of hosts. Woe to them that decree unrighteous decrees, that take away justice from the poor of my people, that widows may be a prey, that they may rob the orphans. That was the language he spoke. So as I say, a man of great importance, great stature. So if Hezekiah wants to send a group of people, an embassy to him, they are all top dignitaries, the top servants or officials in the kingdom. And yet this man had a heart for the common people and the poor among them. A man of great courage, a man of great ability. Very capable man, Isaiah. He found many very effective ways of communicating his message. He knew how to arrest people's attention and to hold it. And I suppose, as far as he was concerned, there were no rules in that game. And in his book, he will employ visions, He will employ songs. He will employ parables. He even engage in symbolic actions. I know we tend to associate that more with Ezekiel. But this man, for 3 years, walked barefoot, clothed only, in the tunic of a prisoner of war, just to get over a graphic picture of Egyptian and Ethiopian captives to Assyria. He was very good with words, a master with words, impossible for us. I know nothing about Hebrew. It's all golf clubs and bedsteads to me. But I'm assured that this man really knew his way around in how he could play with words. His writing is plastered, his book is plastered with very striking images. When he talked about the Assyrian, and I suppose they were the dominating power of the day, he likened them to a swarm of bees, a raging river that overflows its banks to the point that it comes up to your neck, he says. A sharp razor that shaves the hair and the beard. A roaring lion, a rod, an axe. On he went. And that's only talking about one group. And his book is full of word plays. In chapter 1, verse 23, he said, the King James Bible says, your princes are rebellious. NIV gives your rulers are rebels. It is, in fact, a play on words. It's the same word, more or less. So I suppose the best we can get to it is, your rulers are unruly. You know, if you just try to mirror in English. In chapter 5, he will talk about their judgment and oppression. Just look up the verse here. Chapter 5, he looked for justice, behold oppression, righteousness, behold a cry. And the words justice and oppression are more or less the same. They sound almost identical, righteousness and a cry again. And his writings are full of it. I noticed when I was doing some detailed studies a while ago in chapter 42, very familiar verse, Bruce Reed, Messiah, he will not break smoking flax or smouldering flax, he will not quench. He will not fail nor be discouraged. Most translations come up something like that. But in fact, Isaiah was playing with words. They are the same words. A bruised reed he will not break. He will not fail nor be bruised. A smouldering flax he will not quench. He will not himself smoulder. So if you like, a flax that burns dimly he will not quench. He will not burn dimly. Isaiah, very good at these sort of things. You don't need to worry about the detail of it. All I'm saying is, the man was a master with his language. He's a man of great ability. He was also a master of sarcasm. Withering, biting sarcasm. As he tore into the idolaters of his day. He had a favorite word to describe the idols. He used it 10 times. It's not common out of his book. And the word means literally non-entities. Well, you probably know that the normal word in the Old Testament for God is Elohim. Well, this is the word Elohim. It sounds very similar, and he's playing on it, and it means things of nothing, worthless things. We know that an idol is nothing in the world, said Paul in 1 Corinthians 8. And I suspect, with his knowledge of Hebrew, he was playing, in his mind at least, with the same word Isaiah was. And he pokes fun at the people. He pokes fun at the people for the stupidity of turning to witchcraft and supposedly to those who could have intercourse with the dead to find out what the living should do. They say, seek to them that have familiar spirits, to wizards. Should not the people seek to their God rather than the living seek to the dead? Interesting twist from him. But he was at his best when he was deriding them for their idolatry. It's a great passage in chapter 44, I won't read through it. But he takes them to task for these people who form an idol. From the very same piece of wood that they've used to burn, to warm themselves, to cook their meat, to bake their cakes. Same piece of wood, he says. There's a section in chapter 46 which is well worth having a look at when you've got a moment. In verses 4 and 7, he contrasts his God with the gods that these people were worshipping. Even to your old age, I preached it. Even to your old age, I am he. Even to grey hairs, I haven't got any, will I carry you. I have made, I will bear, I will carry, I will deliver you. Then he says, they make a god. They bear him upon the shoulder, they carry him, they set him in his place and he standeth. Same words, Hebrew as well as English. They carry their God, our God carries us from cradle to grave. They bear their God, our God bears us. Their God's completely passive. They have to carry him and dump him and stand him there. Our God, he will deliver us. As I say, Isaiah really let them have it on their idolatry. Well, right then, we can discover some features, I suppose, of Isaiah's character and his ability from his book. But it's quite clear from this absence of very much personal data that the prophet himself was a very humble, self-effacing character. 66 books, and it's hard going to get anything to say about him. I don't doubt that this quality, this characteristic of Isaiah, derives from his sense, his appreciation of the majesty and the transcendence and the towering greatness of the God of Israel. He'd encountered him. And in his sight, in his own sight as well, Isaiah had shrunk, faced with the glory of the Lord. It all started at the beginning, when most things do start, in chapter 6 of his call. That palace temple vision. The Lord, the sovereign Lord, that is, sitting on his throne, high and lifted up. And this prophet was assured that though earthly kingdoms can crumble, and earthly thrones tumble, and earthly monarchs like Uzziah die, yet the Lord of hosts reigns supreme forever. Mine eyes have seen the King, he says, overawed by the Lord's majesty and preeminence, confronted with the Holy One. It's his first encounter. Holy, holy, holy was the chant. The Holy One. The one that was set apart, distinct, different. Cut off from everything else. Just a line here. And everything that side's made and created. And there's one this side, and he's him. The Holy One. And Isaiah was just bowled over by this sense of the infinite distance between him and all creation from the one on the throne. To whom will you liken me, or shall I be equal, saith the Holy One? It's from Isaiah 40. None holy as the Lord, none beside thee. That's not from Isaiah, actually, that's from Hannah in 1 Samuel 2. The high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. The one that's different, away from, separate. Faced with that, it inevitably brought home to him his own sin, first of all, and unworthiness. It certainly did that. Hence that double confession in chapter 6. Unclean, unclean. Confronted with this pure, unblemished holiness of God. He effectively confessed himself a leper. And it prompted this cry, woe is me, I am cut off, I am destroyed, I am ruined. When we look at ourselves, we can be satisfied, self-satisfied. That is quite possible. We can look at other people, we can even feel superior, rightly or wrongly. But what you can't do is have an experience anything like Isaiah's and to look at the Lord and feel comfortable. And feel complacent, and feel smug and self-satisfied. It doesn't work, and it didn't work with him. And from that moment on, this man, in this book here, was emptied of himself. And that, I suggest, is probably the reason why he can write 66 books and say, tell you precious little about himself. He was overawed. But I'll tell you this, that vision in chapter 6 left its marks on him. It coloured everything he said from then on. He took, really, his keynote from that. His favourite title, his distinctive title for the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. 30 times in this book. There's only 8 in all the rest of the Old Testament, and one of those was actually a quote of Isaiah's. It was his title, the Holy One. He realized that that had implications. Much of his ministry carried the impact of that. Because he faced a people. He told them quite clearly what they should be. In chapter 62, he said of the future that they shall be called the holy people. Because this Holy One of Israel not only has a holy mountain and a holy temple, but calls for a holy people, and they were anything but that. I read a while ago in a book I brought back from holiday of a group of students in college who wanted to keep their football mascot, which happened to be a goat, and so they thought they'd smuggle it into the dormitory, and somebody said, but what about the smell? And someone else said, well, you just have to put up with it, won't you? That was a goat. Well, the college boys, like us, I'm not speaking to anybody, college boys may be prepared to put up with conditions like that. But the Lord, the Holy One, was not prepared to put up with a people like that. And this man told them in no uncertain terms that if he was the Holy One, then he required a holy people. He focused a tremendous amount upon this idea of a God who is different and distinct and separate and transcendent and unique and incomparable. Just between chapters 44 and 47 alone, 16 times he got this over. None like me, no other God beside me, none before, none after, and so on. Unique. Great, he says, is the Holy One in the midst of Israel. So against that greatness, this man won't have any qualms about telling us that the whole forests of Lebanon aren't sufficient to burn, or all the beasts of the earth sufficient to provide a sacrifice worthy of him. There is no man-made temple that can contain him. Where the Lord pleads in chapter 6 is a house that you will build me. He was the King, the Lord of hosts, the sovereign, the absolute sovereign Lord. And for that reason, Isaiah believed no reason to fear, because he was in control. I've got chapter 14 in front of me. The Lord of hosts has purposed. Who can reverse it? His hand stretched out. Who will turn it back? He was that kind of God. His purpose would stand. Chapter 46, he declares himself the Lord now. The one who declares the end from the beginning, ancient times, things not yet done, saying, my counsel will stand, I will do all my pleasure. I've spoken, I'll bring it to pass, I've purposed, I will do it. It is a great encouragement, that. A God who knows the end and declares the end from the beginning. And that's why I read from chapter 10. It's an important section. As the Lord stresses that all the empires and monarchs of earth, no matter how great and glorious and grand, are in the end his instruments. They may be unwitting, completely oblivious to the fact, like here's the Assyrian. He doesn't mean so, he doesn't think so. It's in his heart to destroy the nations. The Assyrian's pilgrimage was one of conquest. He wanted to extend his empire. The Lord said, he is effectively the rod that I use. He is an instrument of my will. Isaiah also took away from his call in Isaiah 6 his own insignificance and the insignificance of man in general. There's that great passage in chapter 40, all flesh is grass, that bit. And he goes through the nations, any number of nations. He's talked about them. He's got a whole section of his prophecy devoted to 10 nations. And he's just come in, chapter 40, on the back of chapters 36 to 39, two great empires. Assyria, 36 and 7, Babylon, 38 and 39. Assyria past, Babylon in future. Now that's enough to awe anybody. Not a prophet, though. And in chapter 40, he thinks about these nations. And he tells us of a God who takes these nations up as the drop of a bucket. Not the drop in a bucket, as some translations give. That which hangs down, flows down the bucket. So you've got a chap carrying a bucket, and just this little drip has run down the side. He takes up the nations as the drop of a bucket. As the fine dust of the weighing scales. You've got the arm here, the main part, and there's these microscopic particles on the top. They don't affect the balance, they don't affect the weight in any way. They're too small to do that. Nations are getting smaller. Drop of a bucket, just this microscopic dust settling on the arms of the balances. And then he goes on. He takes them up, he says, they are as nothing before him. You can't get smaller than nothing, can't you? Well, Isaiah thought you could. God's maths don't quite equate with ours. And he goes on, he reckons them or counts them less than nothing. Negative quantity now. You've actually gone into the minus sign with these nations of the world. Isaiah struggling language to convey his sense of the majesty and excellence and greatness of his God. And so he spoke about the Lord bringing down the pride and the haughtiness. You were with me in chapter 2 as we read some of that. As he brings down to size. Chapter 5 goes on again. Mighty man humbled, the eyes of the lofty humbled, the Lord of hosts exalted. Isaiah's youth had been spent during the reign of a king. It's been a very good king, Uzziah. Until the end, and his heart was lifted up to his destruction. Isaiah had witnessed that. Witnessed the price he paid for that pride. And Isaiah steered well clear of it. He went so far as to claim, it's not very pleasant, but he went so far as to claim that that kind of humble and contrite spirit is an absolute necessity for fellowship with God. I'm in chapter 57, verse 15. Thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place. Fine. With him that is of a contrite and humble spirit. And in case you miss it, in chapter 66 he comes back to it. To this man will I look, to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit. So you've got this heaven itself. Is not too great as an abode for the Holy One of Israel, but the humble heart is not too small to provide him a dwelling place either. So he's a man, impressive ability, a master in every way, but nothing in his own eyes, because he had confronted the awesome greatness, this transcendent holiness of the God of Israel. He poked fun at the idols because of their inability to predict the future. Show the things to come hereafter that we may know that you are gods. Well, that didn't get anyone very far. But he himself was in touch with the living God. And this is what he wanted to bring over.